Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. I'd also like to announce that we are an associate of the TCPN, the Commons Project Network, which you can find at www.thecommonsprojectnetwork.com. Good evening, everyone. This is Feed Your Head, and I'm Ruthanna Marte-Theo. We've got two great guests tonight on totally different subjects, except that everything is interconnected. However, tonight we're going to start with Melinda Gonzalez. Hello, Melinda.
Hey, how are you doing, Ruthanna?
Hey. And you can be found at www.organicmelinda.com, right?
Correct.
Yes. And I want to say before we even start further, congratulations. 2 days ago, you published, I believe this is your first cookbook. Am I right? You've got other books out, but this is the first cookbook?
Yeah, it's more than a cookbook. It's more it's a guide on healthy living, mm-hmm. Which includes research that I've done on genetically modified food as well as the health movement. And it also has over 50 recipes in the book sort of that I, you know, came up with together on my own journey towards a healthier lifestyle.
Well, now, before this, you published a couple books of poetry because you are a poet.
Correct.
And mm-hmm. What were those about? I just want to cover that and then get into this new one.
Okay, awesome. In 2007, I was performing poetry, for a couple of years throughout the United States. And my poetry had to do with sort of a journey towards self and self-discovery. I was exploring religion and the spirituality and different aspects of myself as a woman, as a recent college graduate. So the poetry in those books, it's kind of a reflection of those sort of transformative years that we go through in our early 20s. And it's just a reflection of that, you know, falling in love, getting your heart broken, and then trying to pick up the pieces afterwards and you know, figuring out who you are after all of those experiences.
Yeah, things that most of us can identify with in one way or another.
Definitely.
But now you say you are an anthropologist, a poet, an author, an activist, devoted to food justice and food rights. So food being one of my big topics, love it. How did you get interested in food justice and rights?
Okay, it actually started, I think, throughout my life. I was raised by a single mom of three, and, you know, it was always a struggle for us to make sure that we had enough food for the household. I give a lot of respect to my mother and a lot of admiration because I know that she did everything that she could to provide for us as children. And so I think being raised in poverty myself, as I grew up, I was just very aware of social justice issues. I'm from Newark, New Jersey, and, you know, we're one of the largest food deserts in the country. And it was just, you know, kind of growing up in that struggle. But then I became an anthropologist. I started studying anthropology as a freshman in college and traveled the world and, you know, realized, you know, this food is the most essential thing to our existence, to our being, right? It's without air, food, or water, we die. We don't exist anymore. And a lot of people just face food insecurity on a regular basis, on a daily basis. You know, many people in the United States and abroad don't know when they will eat their next meal. And it manifested further. I did research in Nicaragua and worked with homeless children there, which had a very profound experience on me. And I also went to Oaxaca, Mexico, to three years ago, sorry. And while I was there, I was, you know, learning about the, you know, NAFTA and CAFTA agreements, which have created really big problems in Latin America. A lot of farms are being shut down. Families are struggling. You know, we have a huge undocumented migrant population in the U.S., and a lot of it has to do with food justice issues. So, I mean, it's all very interconnected, you know, the different crises that are going throughout the world. But also, you know, I became pregnant 2.5 years ago, and through becoming pregnant, I wanted to make sure that my daughter had the best start in life, and that's kind of where all of these past experiences developed into this current project.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Everything came together then, because while many of us are concerned about our own health, it seems that when it comes to children, people get really concerned, even if they themselves have been living a pretty unhealthy life. Sometimes it's like, wow, you know, I better change because I don't want my kid to be plagued with whatever I am. So that makes sense. When did you decide that you would tackle a book about this lifestyle?
I've been taking a course, an online course with Francesca Escoto Zavala, who is my business coach of sorts. It was a beta project through the Innovators Institute. And so I started off that project actually. I had started a freelance research and editing business after losing my job while on maternity leave. And, you know, Francesca noticed that whenever I talked about food issues, I was very, very just passionate, very passionate, because it's just, I mean, that's my personality in general, but it was, you know, when I talked about food, I would just never shut up. And it was Francesca who made me realize that this was really where I should focus my efforts and begin to find a way to advocate and make a living for myself and my family through doing that. And in one of our conversations, she said to me, you know, I think that, you know, you're vegan and you're Latina and, you know, you have all of this anthropological background. This is a book. You need to write a book because this is what you are and what you do. And so it started off originally as a cookbook. And, you know, I started off with the recipes. And then as the project developed, I'm like, but I'm not a chef. You know, I didn't go to school to learn how to cook. I learned how to cook because I'm a mother. And my toddler went through a lot of sort of picky stages. And, you know, I've been cooking for myself my whole life. And, you know, well, you know, the years my mother wasn't cooking for me, right? But so it was in the process of writing the book that it started becoming a movement of its own, you know, and for me, it was like, you know, it's not enough for me to share these vegan Latino recipes. It's important for me to talk about why I have chosen this lifestyle, why I believe it's important, what is really going on, you know, and I've been working on independent research on the food movement and the Grow Foods Not Lawns movement, and just, you know, food growing and people kind of trying to reclaim, you know, our sustenance, our way of living. And so the book has all of that in there. You know, there are chapters about what are GMO foods. Most people don't know that so many of our food items are genetically modified. They don't even know what that means.
Almost
so there's
all
a chapter. You know, so there's a chapter on that. And there's also a lot of misconceptions about living an organic lifestyle, which for me, an organic lifestyle, how I define it, is not as USDA organic. Rather, it's organic in the sense of being as close to nature as possible and being, you know, natural, being who you are. And so I talk about that and also kind of deconstruct these myths that have been built around the idea that being vegetarian and living an organic lifestyle are things that only wealthy people can access. So So as someone who was, you know, raised in poverty and has, you know, struggled financially throughout my life for various reasons, you know, this awesome recession that we're going through, a little sarcasm there, but, you know, it is possible to not be rich and be a vegetarian and eat healthy and secure good quality food for your family. So that's, you know, the book is both of those things. It's recipes, you know, to give people ideas on how to get out of the prepackaged aisle and get back into the kitchen.
Yes.
And also, you know, to let people know, I did this, you know, and you can do it too.
That's important. That's very important. Somebody was talking with me on the phone today and saying that, you know, she's on a very limited income. And she said, I just don't know how to eat the way you're talking about, because she knows I'm vegan. And it's like, well, I was telling her, I don't have money either, but, you know, I do fine and I'm quite healthy. And it was just, people are led to believe that they have to have money to be vegan or vegetarian. And that's really not the case. You can spend as much as you want and you can be as unhealthy as you want being vegan. I mean, I know some vegans that are very unhealthy. You can tell by looking at them because they're still eating junk. And the same as vegetarians. But like you said, get out of the package aisles. You know, if you're in the supermarket, you do the outside, which is your produce, and then you get some frozen vegetables or fruit that you couldn't get fresh, and you're pretty much done. At least that's the way I figure it. But
yeah.
How long have you been? Now, are you vegan or vegetarian, Melinda?
I'm a vegan. I've been, when I was 9 years old, I became vegetarian.
Okay.
And then at 14, I became vegan. It was a nice shock for my Puerto Rican mother, right? And, you know, we went through different, you know, struggles and things like that. But I'm just excited. I'm really excited because there are so many Latinos who are vegan, and we're actually, you know, the largest, the fastest growing minority group in the United States. We're not a minority group by any means throughout the rest of the world.
Right.
And so, you know, and there is this kind of callback to nature and culture. And that's one of the things that I also, there's a chapter in my book that's a reclamation of Latino ingredients. And, you know, a lot of the times people don't know that something like chia seeds, right, is from Latin America. Corn, potatoes, maca, all of these things that are perceived to be part of this, like, you know, white, suburban, health-conscious movement are foods that are part of our cultural heritage. And so that's one of the things that for me is really important as an anthropologist, is to deconstruct these mythologies that have been built around who has the right to access food and healthy food at that, and who owns, you know, the history behind these food items. And it's really interesting because I was in a tweet chat today, and someone had made a comment about, well, how do you feel when people who have food stamps buy organic food at the supermarket? And for me, it's a conversation that I've had many times, and I think an unnecessary conversation because of the classist notions that are behind the idea that poor people should not be able to buy organic food. It's really intense when you think about the politics of food. If you want to uplift a community and take them away from poverty, then should we not be investing in their health? And so for me, Organic Melinda is a movement. It's not just a cookbook. It's not a blog. It's about reclaiming our ingredients, reclaiming our health, and saying, yes, I'm having a tough financial time. That doesn't mean that I should be damned to live an unhealthy life for the rest of my life, or that my children and their children should also have to eat genetically modified food because we're quote-unquote poor.
Because we're poor, exactly. I did want to say that your book is called LIV2E, which stands for Latin-Inspired Vegan and Vegetarian Eats. And where can this be purchased, Melinda?
My book can be purchased on my website. It's www.organicmelinda.com. And the title is actually Live. And the concept is kind of Live Squared. I went to science high school in Newark, New Jersey as a kid. And so I'm really into the sciences and things like that. And I kind of wanted to play to the nerdy side of who I am because I am a proud nerd. and also, you know, it is both vegan and vegetarian. I think the term vegan intimidates a lot of people because it's perceived to be extreme. And so for that reason, I also added the idea of being a vegetarian because all vegans are vegetarian. we're just a little more, away from the animal products. And my child herself is not a vegan. Her father and I didn't agree on raising her vegan, so we're letting her kind of make that decision for herself throughout her life by exposing her. I mean, she's mostly vegetarian because I'm the one who cooks. But, yeah, the book is on my website right now. It's on sale for $19.99. And if you use the word promo, P-R-O-M-O, in the discount code section, you will get a discount for the book, and that's for the month of September. So, yeah, I mean, I'm really excited. My idea with the title Live is that, you know, we should be living. And the way to do that is to ensure that we are eating the best, highest quality food for our buck. And just one thing I wanted to note is that a lot of food is organic, but it's not labeled as such because of the politics of organic. And this again, is a class issue. A lot of family farms cannot afford to label their farms organic, but they
are. Thousands of dollars. Yes, it's very expensive.
Yes, very expensive.
Yeah.
So please, in my book, I also discuss this issue. I talk about why we ought to be supporting local farmers. I am pro-farmers, and there's so many food items that you can grow even on your windowsill in an apartment because I do it. And so I want to deconstruct this idea that you have to be rich to eat healthy and organic and to live a good life. And also deconstruct the idea of what expensive is, because I know that some organic food items are more expensive than conventional. However, you have to think of the long-term cost of what that means. The cancer rate has escalated. People have tumors. There's large infertility issues in this country and very young people. A lot of diseases are plaguing us that have not traditionally plagued us or historically. So we have to really reconsider what we mean by cost. I would rather walk everywhere and not own a car and have a refrigerator full of the healthiest food that my daughter can eat. Because for me, I think about her long-term health and, you know, and just her quality of life.
Well, and the quality of life, that goes into the fact that if you're living a vegan lifestyle, you're walking very lightly on the planet. And we aren't responsible for the rainforest coming down, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that also...
And that's another issue that my book doesn't directly touch on, but is very important. Genetically modified crops are adding to deforestation. And this is a world issue. I mean, this is affecting everyone around the globe. If we continue to put chemicals into the air and the water and our land, what are we leaving for our children? And what are we putting into our own bodies? So definitely, like I said, I feel like the work I'm doing is a movement to ensure, you know, a better future for my children and generations to come for everyone of all colors, races, and classes.
Oh, right. I mean, we really should be civilized enough now to get past all these borders and boundaries and just realize we're all family around the world, even though our governments may not want to go with that. I know that you've done quite a bit of research on body image, and I'd like to know how you got interested in that.
Okay, awesome. So body image is just a super important issue for women and girls and just everyone. A lot of the times we think that, you know, this relates to the whole concept of health. We live in a low-fat, low-calorie kind of culture here in the U.S. and probably, you know, in other parts of the world. I can only speak from my experiences here, where we are obsessed with the concept of being thin. And rightly so, because from being a small child, people are constantly making comments about our bodies, and as women and as men as well. I want to deconstruct the idea, too, that women are the only ones that have body image issues and the only ones struggling with food disorders, because men do as well. And so, you know, that's part of my push is to eating real food, is because if we move away from the boxes and the advertisements that promise us these false images of health, you know, we can eat, you know, large portions of food and not worry about, you know, obesity and disease and things like that. You know, eating a huge salad is going to be good for you. You don't have to eat a 50-calorie bag of cookies to be all right. But the body image thing, it was kind of born from my own experiences. I struggled with my weight a little bit as a child, and I received a lot of cruelty from people for misconceptions about what a woman's body should be. And so after having my daughter, I weighed about 162 pounds. I'm 5'1" inches. And, you know, people would kind of make comments because I breastfed my daughter and I wanted to weigh to ensure, you know, the best quality of milk for her. And I'm still breastfeeding her. I'm a very big advocate for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would make comments about my body. And I actually had a friend who is no longer a friend because of these comments that would send pictures to me of women who had a child similar to my age and would kind of, you know, women who, you know, just kind of bounce back into, you know, their prepartum bodies or things like that. You know, but a lot of the time we see these images, but we don't know if these women were crash dieting, had liposuction. You know, we don't really know what is happening. And exactly. I felt as a postpartum woman that there is just too much pressure for us to, like, be 15-year-old in our bodies again. You know, like, it's not going to happen. Your body's going to change after you have a child in different ways, and there should be no shame in how your body changes. And so I found that. And so I would kind of receive pressure from different angles, and not just people, but from media images, you know, like, lose your baby weight fast and just all of these things, right? And so when I was ready, I kind of went back into my exercise routine and, you know, kind of cutting my calories a little bit because I had a tough pregnancy and I was very excited to eat again after giving birth. So I went back to, you know, just eating really well and a balanced diet and not overeating. And it's something I talk about too in my blog, that I've struggled with emotional eating and overeating, and a lot of us do. I think all of us probably do to some extent. So after kind of exercising back again, I lost 32 pounds. And I was lighter than I had been, almost 10, 15 pounds lighter than I had been prepartum. And so all of a sudden, I was too skinny. And people were asking me questions like, you know, where did your butt go? And, you know, sometimes as a jest, but those jests come with these notions of truth, you know, of ideas about, you know, a woman's body. And so I started also really exercising because I became interested in bodybuilding, because I just think there's something really amazing about a woman who, you know, takes her body to the next level and you know, just does something different with it, you know. Be fit and be healthy. And sure, that's, for me, being a role model for my daughter, I want her to see a mother who's strong and able and, you know, emulate that, because children copy what they see. I mean, that's how we learn. I mean, I can say that as an anthropologist, we learn through imitation and mimicking. So it was very frustrating for me when I started revealing these things. Oh, you know, I would post pictures of different bodybuilding, you know, figure models and bikini competitors, and all of a sudden there were these comments like, oh, you don't want to look manly. You don't want to, you know, don't get too muscular, you know. And I was just, you know, kind of interrogating that, right? Because I started having people make comments about my body when I was 9 years old. And I am 29 years old, and people are still making comments about my body. And, you know, it was kind of like, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right? So if you are a woman who, or a man who, you know, sits at home and doesn't exercise and that's your life and you're happy with that, people pass judgments on you. You're lazy, you must be obese, you must be diseased, you must be this, you must be that. You know, you probably have diabetes. I mean, I hear people making comments about, you know, individuals who struggle with their weight, you know, sort of like they're costing me tax dollars and this and that, you know. And then if you're exercising every single day and you're a woman who can bench press 200 pounds, now you're a man. So it's been really frustrating, and I've talked to a lot of women about these issues. So that is something that I really want to continue to work on, to uplift. You know, I have a daughter, and even as a baby, she's 17 months old, and she's mixed race. Her father is, he's Jamaican by way of England, rather English by way of Jamaica, and also from Trinidad, and I'm Puerto Rican. So even when she was born, people made comments about whether or not she would be too dark, or her hair would be nappy, you know, or just comments about good hair versus bad hair, and I hope your daughter has good hair.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, as a child, I mean, she was like a month old, and already, as you know, her body was already a subject to be scrutinized. And, of course, as a mother, right, that kind of pissed me off.
Okay, so you want to just slap people. Do you find the body image, different cultures have different things that they consider beautiful,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, even healthy? And I know an ex of mine has, you know, he and his friends would use the word healthy, like so-and-so looks healthy. And to me, you know, that was just pretty much a large person.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a couple remarks, and he wasn't trying to be mean, but because I know after I really got healthy and just I dropped some more weight and I just, you know, the whole thing. And he's going, well, you know, you used to have more, like your boobs were bigger and your butt was bigger and blah, blah. And maybe you should gain some weight back. And, you know, I gave him one of those looks, like, what in the world? You know, you're not my boyfriend now anyway. But, you know, do you know what you're saying? You just want to be with fat women? What? But it's
well,
strange.
That's, I mean, it's really intense, right? Because I feel like I'm all about body acceptance, right? So if you are comfortable at 200 pounds, then we should accept that, you know. If you are comfortable at 102 pounds, we should accept that. I think that, you know, if, you know, men do have these issues. As a woman, I can't really speak for men. I do know men who have struggled with anorexia and bulimia and body dysmorphia disorder. And I feel like a lot of the times we associate thinness with health, and that's not always the case, because we don't know how someone has gotten thin. And so I like that the movement is moving towards being fit, You know, the concept mm-hmm. of fit is the new skinny. You know, I hear people say this all the time. So definitely, and I write about this in my book, I included a exercise plan that was designed by Lori Brennan Graham, who is a personal trainer and holistic nutritionist. And I also included my own workout plan. I do capoeira, which is a Brazilian martial art. So that for me is awesome. And it's, you know, I think what it is when we think of health and we think of being fit, we have to stop at looking at the body, right? Because you can have a body that aesthetically looks healthy and fit, but can be full of disease on the inside, or a mind that is full of disease, you know? So you can look aesthetically pleasing, but you can actually, you know, have an eating disorder, or, you know, have a mental disorder, or, you know, kind of be going through the motions of, like, I need to go to the gym 4 times a day in order to be happy with what I look like, and then you never feel comfortable with what you look like. And I think that that's the problem, is that, you know, and another issue that has happened, and I can attest to this being Latina, that there's this concept that, you know, a response to the movement of, you know, accepting, you know, bodies that were not skinny, right? Because women who are overweight, or women who struggle with their bodies, or men as well, our culture is constantly telling them that there's something wrong with them, you know? And there are people who, you know, are obese for different reasons, medical problems. A friend of mine was talking to me about a friend of hers who, his father was in Vietnam, and he had exposure to Agent Orange. And because of that, her friend was obese, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the side effects of Agent Orange.
So many things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, I think we just think that people have a lack of willpower.
Exactly.
But you're talking about, you know, how people can be so hurtful. And a friend of mine who has quite a bit of weight on him and really isn't healthy, but he was very hurt. He was at a candy machine, mm-hmm. and where he works. And someone came up and said, well, I bet you know this machine really well. You're probably here all
right.
the time. And it was just, he didn't know who this person was. It's like, what a thing to say to someone. You know,
yeah.
stand up.
I mean, that's...
But just to say it? And he's a very sensitive person, and he's already, you know, concerned about his weight kind of thing. It just really was painful.
And that's... You know, it's really ironic, because a lot of the times we shame people who are heavier for eating. And it's scientifically proven that we hold on weight when our bodies are in caloric deficit. And if you're not eating enough calories, you can actually be heavy, because your body's always in starvation mode. And so I've read a lot about this. You know, doctors and nutritionists who have to advise patients who are overweight that they have to eat more. And our society is constantly telling us to eat less and to eat less and to eat less. And I mean, I've had those experiences when I was a child and I was vegetarian. I was bullied by a guy who pinned me down in the playground and put bologna all over my face, and said to me, you know, you want to eat it, fatty. You know you want to eat it, you know. And so this concept, and at that time I was already struggling with anorexia, you know. So it's really intense. And I mean, the more ironic issue is when people who are overweight, go to the gym. They get snide remarks, and they get stared at, and they get comments, and people demonize them, right, for the very same thing that other people have pushed them to do constantly, right? So it's, and this is what I'm talking about with this whole damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? So as a woman, as someone who has struggled with weight, you know, or If you're not healthy, people criticize you. And then when you're trying to get healthy, you're being criticized for being healthy. I've had so many people call me extreme for being a vegan, for wanting to eat local and organic food, for wanting to raise my daughter in that same lifestyle. I've said things like, I never want my daughter to have dairy. you know, and because I breastfeed her, and to me it's not really, I understand that a lot of women have to give their children cow's milk for various reasons, whether they work or they don't produce milk themselves. But then, you know, then someone will say to me, oh, well, what if she wants to? Or, haha, you can't make her do that. You know, so, I mean, it's just constant scrutiny, right? So I just, you know, for me, I think that the best thing to do is to lead by example. And so, you know, I do really promote body acceptance. And that's really, I think a body can, so many bodies are beautiful. And as an anthropologist, we do. We have different perceptions of what beauty is culturally. For example, traditionally in many cultures, being heavy, you know, having extra weight on your body was desirable because it was viewed as a sign of wealth. You know, because people who were in poverty did not have enough food, so they would be thin. And so being skinny was actually viewed as being something bad because it meant you were hungry and you were poor. And then there's the cultural perspective of, you know, women having bigger hips. In a lot of indigenous cultures, that is what's desired, a woman with big hips and big thighs, because that means that her body is more able to bear large amounts of children. Mm-hmm. You know, so we do have different ideas. I think that we do need to be careful with some of the images that, or rather phrases that we use to promote body acceptance sometimes as well. And this is something that I talk about also, having been an anthropologist who studies women and gender studies. There are bodies that are gendered in different ways. And a lot of the times we reify notions of masculine and feminine, of what's male and what's female, based on ideas of what body should look like. And what it does is that it puts people who, I mean, one out of every 1,000 people in the U.S. that is born as intersex. They are neither male or female. And I know this is a shocking thing for a lot of people to imagine that our male-female sexual dichotomies are kind of simplistic and that they're people who don't necessarily fit into that. Not just that, but when people do fit into these sexed bodies or gendered bodies, and you say something like, a real woman has curves, then are we saying that women who do not have large breasts and big butts are not real women, you know?
Exactly.
Or things like, and this is a conversation that I got into with a friend of mine who was, I was really disappointed because he's really conscious on a lot of things. And when I posted this image of a female fitness model who, it's just a story of inspiration. Her name is Teresa Jen Lopatrone, and she struggles with her body, and now she's a professional fitness model, and she's very honest about the struggles that she went through to get to where she is now. And I posted a picture of her, and the immediate response was, don't get too muscular. And then he and I had this conversation where he said things like, you know, women are supposed to have breasts and plastic. It was just like this whole idea that a feminine body cannot be masculine. And so I said to him, then are male bodies who are not muscular feminine, right? And he was like, no. And I'm like, so then why are female bodies who are muscular then masculine? And then, you know, he said things about, like, how a woman has breasts and she has a butt and things like that. And then I thought to myself, well, what happens to women who have breast cancer and have to get their breasts removed? Are they less women? Or what about women who, you know, we have all of these ideas, right, about what makes a woman a woman. You know, she has breasts, she has a butt, she has a uterus. You know, she can bear children. And same thing for a man, right? He has to have these certain characteristics. But so many people don't fit into that. What about a woman who can't reproduce? Is she not a woman now? A woman who doesn't have breasts, is she not a woman now? You know, a woman who has undergone a hysterectomy, is she no longer a woman because her body doesn't have those markers that we think are supposed to make her a woman? And so for me, body, I mean, this is where we exist, right? Our body is what we are in so many ways. And so when we attack bodies on a daily basis, for so many reasons. I mean, what are we doing to each other? And this for me, my book title, you know, it's like a healthier lifestyle. When I say healthier, I don't mean just what you eat. I mean how you think, how you perceive the world, your spirituality, how you feel. I want everyone in the world to wake up and look in the mirror and feel love and comfort in who they are, in their bodies. You know, and I think that food is so important to that, because what you eat, you know, has such a deep impact on your cognitive abilities, on, you know, how your heart, you know, pumps blood, how your intestines work, you know, and all of that, how your skin is. So I really think that when we kind of go back and we say, you know what, forget all of this GMO BS. Let's forget, you know, all of this box stuff. Let's come back and eat the food that our great-grandparents ate. You know, who, and I mean, my great-grandmother lived till she was 117 years old. She ate everything fresh from her backyard. So when I think that when we go back and reclaim food, right, when we say we're going to start growing our own food, we're going to support local farmers, we're going to say no, just say no to GMOs, say, you know, say no to corporations, and go back and say, you know what, I'm going to eat healthy for me and my kids, and, you know, I'm going to change, I'm going to start that change from within. And that's when I think those outer changes happen. And I can attest to that for myself. You know, I don't eat perfect 100% of the time. I'm a product of my culture, you know. I see all those advertisements everywhere I go to that tell me to eat crap. You know, but I've noticed the difference. If I go and I sit down and I eat a box of cookies, afterwards I feel tired, I feel lazy. You know, my brain, I can't really think as clearly, I can't sleep as well. And then when I eat just a wholesome diet, I just feel so much alive and so much more energized and so much more capable.
There's a big difference, and you can tell. You really can, if you sort of slip off. And, you know, the thing is, we don't deprive ourselves of anything. We make choices, like, to be healthy. And, yeah, once in a while we goof. But I wanted to ask you, Melinda, do you have friends who maybe they're not vegan, but they really watch out for you? Because I've been blessed with several friends who, I mean, they'll check the ingredients. We're going out, and they want to make sure we go someplace that I can eat. If we're in a supermarket, they're reading the backs of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have friends that are supportive?
Oh, definitely. I mean, here's the beauty of my mother and my sister and my family, and something too that gave birth to my book is that, you know, when I became vegan, my mom was like, "Oh my God, what am I going to feed this kid?" You know,
right. Where was she getting the protein? You know, the number one output.
Yeah, well,
from my kale.
No,
thank
you.
You from veggies. Yeah.
And it was hard for her because Puerto Rican food culturally is just tons of. I mean, we have a lot of stews, we have a lot of vegetables and things like that, but a lot of it has meat in it. And so, all of a sudden, my mom had to be really creative in the kitchen, right? Which I thank her for. She's in my book, and I featured my favorite meal that she's made me, that she veganized for me when I was a kid. And, you know, she's in the book with a picture of herself, and, you know, she's been so supportive. You know, she had to completely change her kitchen and be like, oh, wait, I'm not, you know, not buying meat. And, of course, you know, she, like, would put stuff in my food sometimes and be like, oh, she'll get over it. It's a phase. And after 20 years, I guess she's realized that it's not a phase.
Yeah.
But she did. She changed. I mean, she made me vegan pasteles and empanadas and, you know, just really, and, you know, now it's so amazing how life comes full circle, and it's like now I'm the one kind of teaching her how to eat healthy, right, and kind of how to get back into you know, the ingredients in the kitchen and kind of talking to her about going gluten-free and just, you know, like, because what happens is, you know, you get busy with life and then there's all of these matters of conveniences in boxes and, you know, you kind of, it's easier to just pop something in the microwave or in the oven. But, you know, my mom was really just supportive and, you know, Thanksgiving dinners. I mean, I don't really celebrate Thanksgiving because it's a colonial thing to me, but,
right.
You know, at the same time, you know, I celebrate things like, you know, I'm not Christian, but I go to Christmas stuff because that's important to my family. And so they, you know, my mom and my sister, before my sister became vegan, which she is now, you know, they would prepare food for me so that just to make sure I could eat. And, you know, they would veganize things for me all of the time. And also my friend, you know, when they invite me to parties, I'll be like, okay, I'll have one vegan dish for you, at least one. And it's what amazes me, though, now is how many of my relatives and just friends, even meat eaters, right? Like, I know a lot of people who just really love meat. And all of a sudden, they're coming to me about, you know, how do I eat healthier? I feel sick, and you seem healthy, so what do I do? Like, can you give me some advice? You know, and it's been amazing because through my own sort of journey towards, like, eating healthy and organic, it's like I'm inspiring my family and I'm inspiring my friends. And, you know, the other day, like, a complete stranger sent me an email and was like, wow, you know, like, I'm just reading about your journey and you're so inspirational and you really made me think about, you know, what I'm doing and what I'm feeding my kids. And that to me is just absolutely just mind-blowing and amazing and such a, you know, it's such a moment to be proud of, you know, the things that I've accomplished. And I know that as women we're told to be humble all of the time, but, you know, I think we need to deconstruct that. And be proud, like, be proud of, like, where we've come from.
Why not? You know? I mean, you know, accept it because, like, you work hard and you're where you are. People recognize that there's nothing wrong with saying, wow, that's really nice that somebody, you know, patted me on the back.
It's excellent. I've had so much support throughout my life in this journey, and I'm so grateful. And I really want to inspire other people as well because, I want us to be healthy as a people. We won't need to worry about all these HMOs and things like that. If we were just healthy, you know, if we had access to really good quality food, you know, how much of the diseases that we struggle with on a daily basis, you know, would go away.
But you know what, it's going to, since everything is interconnected, it's going to take quite a movement because Big Pharm doesn't want you to be healthy because they make money off of prescriptions. The healthcare system, all the you buck a lot of big corporations that are in place, and I mean Monsanto. So it's quite a journey, and you know
it is, and that's why things like Proposition 37 in California were defeated in many ways. There's a lot of misinformation being given to the public, and that's where things like Organic Melinda, you know, come to the fore, right? Because I'm not the only one. There's so many of us, and I want us to come together and really work together because the only way that we're going to be able to guarantee the integrity of our food, you know, is by working together and by helping educate the public. So right now, with my website, I'm actually going to start setting up consultations and workshops in the next coming weeks because really one of my goals is to go out to schools and organizations and start the work because, you know, and sometimes it's really hard to access parents because they're busy. In this economy, there are people working 2, 3, 4, 5 jobs just to make a living, you know, and so I think that that's where it becomes important. We can't preach to people about what they should be feeding their kids and what they should be doing with themselves. We need to guide, and that's why I call my book a guide, because first you need to help people understand that there is a problem, you know, and help them go through the motions. I have a good friend who works 45-hour week, also working on her own business, has two children, and, you know, has like a 16-hour workday every single day sometimes because she's working on both of her things and really trying to establish herself as an independent entrepreneur so she doesn't have to be away from her children 45 hours a week or more for transportation reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I started talking to her, she was really overwhelmed because she had just learned about genetically modified food. And she had just, you know, she said to me, oh, my God, what am I doing to my baby, you know? And she was so overwhelmed that she was paralyzed, you know? And so that happens to a lot of people, that sometimes we push too hard and we paralyze them. And a lot of people are just like, you know, I don't know what to do, and it's too overwhelming, so I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And so that's why I think it's important to do things like, you know, I blog and I give people tips. And,
right.
And you know, I give tips about how to eat organic on a budget. I give tips about how to, you know, balance your work and family life. How, you know, how to stop emotional eating. You know, because all of this is about our health, right? It's not just the food, it's our habits. So, you know, I told my friend, you know, you have to start small, okay? If you're giving your kids, let's say, I mean, she was not giving her kids McDonald's, but if you are, if every day you come home and, you know, you pass by McDonald's and you give your kids chicken nuggets and french fries, and that's what they eat for dinner, and you're like, where do I start? They really like chicken nuggets and french fries, and I don't know what else to give them because they won't eat anything else because that's what they're used to. Then, you know, I'm a vegan, and it would be great if the whole world became vegan. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but I, you know, I tell people start small. You know, go buy potatoes and get free-range chicken, you know, and you start that transition slowly, right? So that you're moving your kids away from McDonald's, right? And you're not just taking away the McDonald's and then putting a salad in front of them because that might be too sharp of a change for some kids. And, you know,
kids like to grow things. And, you know, there's a lot of places now, more than any time, I guess, since the Second World War in this country, people are doing community gardens. And this is one way to make sure people have the food. They're learning about it. Kids are learning. They like to grow things. They like to eat.
So that, I mean, that's one of the reasons I want to start doing workshops and consultations because I would love to, you know, get together with local, there are a lot of urban farmers. I mean, I'm in Newark, New Jersey. There are farmers markets in the city. There are a lot of urban farmers in the city. The problem is that people don't know that these things exist. So that's where I come in. That's where shows like yours come in. That's where the movement has to come in, right? There are all these resources. Now we need to connect the communities that need the resources, right? Because, you know, a lot of people don't have cars. They shouldn't have to go to Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or somewhere else, you know, to get overpriced organic food. You know, they should know that there are farmers markets and that there are urban gardeners and that there are alternatives. I mean, you have a roof. You can grow food on your roof. So I think that's what we need to do. And so I want to start doing workshops and consultations. And, you know, if anyone is interested, you know, they can reach out to me at my email, which is organicmelinda@gmail.com. And we can talk about, you know, how to proceed. Because, like I said, you know, my goal is for all of us to eat 100% GMO-free, you know. But for a lot of people, that has to start one step at a time, you know. And so for me, I have the patience to work with someone and get them there one step at a time. And so that's one of the cautions that I want to say to the non-GMO movement is that you can't expect someone who eats out every day and buys all prepackaged to go from that to growing their own food in a day. It's not necessarily feasible for everyone. So we need to start one step at a time and support people wherever they are in their journey. And this is the same thing that goes with body image and that goes with health in general, you know, and mental health. We all have our vices in different ways. And so I think that instead of critiquing and attacking, And, you know, I mean, this is what happens a lot, I think, in movements, is that we ostracize people because we're so passionate that we need to say, you know, I understand where you are. How can I help you? Tell me, you know, all right, let's start with you eat GMOs three meals a day. Let's change your breakfast. Let's start eating non-GMO for breakfast, you know. So, and then, you know, transition one step at a time, and then I think we can get to a place where, you know, we can have healthy bodies and a lot of these other issues just start going away.
But it's all connected, which is, it was, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just marvelous, really, the connections we have with other people, and not just people, but the planet, what we're growing, our bodies. When we're little, we were told, you are what you eat, and nobody really mm-hmm. got it seems. But now, more than ever, I really understand that. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to ask, because now you have your little girl, and so you're more concerned than you probably were before. Are you going to do some type of programs, get some kind of a workshop, something set up for like preschool or early grades, maybe some kind of something?
Definitely. That is what I'm envisioning now. I'm in the process of talking with my business coach about how to set everything up, because I want it to be affordable, but it also needs to be feasible for myself. Because this is my organic mold is that this is my livelihood. So, you know, I would like to be able to dedicate myself 100% to this endeavor. And so I need to be able to also support myself and my family by doing so, which is what the book is for as well, you know, to be able to generate income, because by generating that income, then I can go ahead and really focus on educating the public, you know, 100% of the time. And, yes, as a mother, you know, you know, children are so fickle sometimes, you know, like my daughter will, one day she like really loves crunchy food and it's all about crunchy food and she does not want to taste anything else. She's like, nope, I just want crackers all day long, you know, and the next week it's all about bread. It's like, no, I just want bread. I just want, and then another week is she's like obsessed with hummus and beans, you know, so. You know, sometimes as parents, we're like, oh, my God, how am I going to give my child a balanced diet when all she wants to eat is crunchy stuff? And so in my book, I have recipes that are really, a lot of them are really inspired by my daughter. And I write about that. I'm like, you know, one day I'm like, man, she hasn't eaten greens all day. How am I going to get her to eat some greens? And
make
so... yeah, you know, so like sometimes she'll like smoothies and sometimes she'll hate them. So I really would love to do workshops with moms of like toddlers and just small children on how to kind of start, how to get them to eat really, really yummy food that, you know, kind of, I mean, advertising companies have been like, you know, they hire anthropologists and psychologists and all these, you know, people to really do all of this incredible market research on what attracts the mind of a child, you know, repetition, mm-hmm. bright colors, rapid movement, and all of these things, you know,
Melinda, our time is up, but I want to say www.organicmelinda.com, and on Facebook, you are there under Organic Melinda.
Correct. I'm everywhere under Organic Melinda, Instagram, Tumblr, WordPress, all over the place.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is Live, it's LIV2E, in Latin-inspired vegan and vegetarian eats, and it is on your website.
Correct. It is on my website. It's on sale right now, so everyone get a copy and get one for your friend as well. And let's make this movement real.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Melinda Gonzalez at www.organicmelinda.com.
Using ancient techniques taught by our ancestors, we express the spirit of tradition from cultures all across the planet. We blend by hand and we create with light and intention for use, using fragrance and subtle essences to awaken your sensuality, both physical and subtle, all for the mystical exploration of you. DaughtersofIsis.com. Come find us.
Now we have with us, Mimi, you're going to have to tell me how to pronounce your last name. I'm sorry, because I'm afraid I'm going to mess it up. How do you say your last name?
Can you hear me, Ruthann?
Yes,
Okay, my last name, it's Saltisic. So it's like Saltisic.
Saltisic. Okay.
Uh-huh.
This is Saltysik.
Right.
Yes.
First name is Emidio Mimi Saltisic. But just Mimi is fine for here.
Right. That's what this is the first time I actually saw when you got this Facebook page up. That, his name is Emidio. Yeah. Okay.
Right. It is.
Emidio.
Yeah.
You are the chair of the Socialist Party of California, and you're the male vice chair at Socialist Party USA. You have decided to run for 62nd State Assembly District. What on earth made you decide to run for this office, maybe?
I think that... the first thing I just want to make really clear is that for us, running a campaign at this level, it's not about winning. I think there's a quote by Eugene V. Debs that says, we run not for votes, but we run for the movement. So as we try to sort of plant the seeds and educate and inform and continue to try to build community, we'll use every tool in the toolbox to try to do that. And running an electoral campaign and using that platform to share ideas and things like that. The local that I happen to belong to, which is the Los Angeles local, we do everything democratically. So we came to a decision, a democratic decision, to wage this particular campaign and to use it as a platform to discuss socialism. And also, I think if anybody goes to the Facebook page, they'll see that we're kind of going about this in a different way than from what people might expect from a traditional campaign. Although I'll be filing the paperwork and on election day, my name will be on the ballot. What we did right out of the gate was, as soon as that Facebook page went up, you started to see statements from socialists about why socialism, why are they socialists. And these are people who are, you know, students, mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, et cetera. We, as opposed to this just being an identity campaign, we really wanted to make this about the people, because this is the people's movement. The Socialist Party USA is a democratic socialist party. So to us, we really wanted to put a human face on socialism and really give the public an opportunity to hear directly from real socialists. Why did they come to this decision? What is life like for them? What have they experienced? And that's what we've started to do, and we're going to carry that out throughout this entire campaign.
Well, now, I know that your friend and mine, Stuart Alexander, who has a show on the station, ran last year for the office of president on the Socialist USA. And, I mean, there was no way, no one, most of all Stuart, never, ever figured to win anything. But it was just, like you said, putting it out there, letting people know that we do have options. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we say frequently for people to start at the local level.
Correct.
Because, you know, whether it's the school board or whatever, you may be surprised and make it in. What are your chances, actually, of getting this particular position? Do you think that they're pretty good, Mimi?
I don't. And to be honest with you, I running at this level as one socialist on the state assembly level in California, you know, to win, you know, you'd get swallowed up by that institution. So as we are starting to build from the grassroots level, where our focus is entirely on the local level, community level, what success to us is isn't defined by victory on election day. Success to us is the conversation that we have, you know. And it's about, ideally, that conversation leading to some people, leading to folks making a decision to join us in this effort, sort of in this fight for humanity, in this fight against those who place, you know, profit at the expense of the people. So everything feeds back into the local level. So really the idea of winning, I think in my assembly district, I think there might be just under 500,000 people. Excuse me. You know, the incumbent is a Democrat, and really to us, he's not really the opposition. Capitalism, the opposition.
Exactly.
So, you know, we define what victory to us perhaps is. And that may be disappointing to some people who would prefer
They would like to actually see a socialist win here and there. But we know that the unit party has the money, and money counts. So just getting the conversation switched around, you know, when I grew up, socialism and communism were four-letter words, basically.
Right.
Because, you know, that was just what we were taught. Maybe not in so many words, but that was the idea. And, you know, oh, capitalism was the all-seeing, all-knowing, the most wonderful thing ever. Mm-hmm. And once you learn that that's not the case, it's just like mine opens up totally. So I've had people tell me, you really need another word besides socialism and communism. Like those words, you know, they have the this negative meaning. And I say, well, then we just need to change people's perception, because the words actually describe what we are, and there's nothing wrong with the words.
Yeah,
but
I think it's our responsibility I think for too long, you know, the mainstream media and the Democratic parties, the Republican parties, they have defined who we are and what socialism means, and I think that it's our responsibility and running a campaign like this, you know, to start to show the public they don't get to define who we are. We define who we are.
Right.
You know? And to start to take that power back from them. And again, that's sort of another goal of this campaign is to, you know, we don't have to disassociate ourselves from the word. We have to be clear about what that word means, and we have to be honest in what that word means. Whether it's socialism, communism, and that sort of thing. And again, to sort of take that power back from mainstream media and from the Democrats and Republicans, you know, or libertarians, whoever. We're here, you know, and you're hearing already from people throughout this campaign, they are providing definitions. They're defining who they are and what they want and what they mean. And again, to us, that's a success.
Well, I'd like a little bit of background for you yourself, like how you came to become socialist, or maybe you always were. What about your family? Just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I was raised outside of Reading, Pennsylvania, and Reading is just a textbook example of everything that's wrong with capitalism. I mean, the place has been absolutely devastated. It's brutal, and it's terribly sad. my parents, both very hardworking, very kind, very generous. I, on the other hand, as a kid, I was a skateboarder kid. I was really into punk rock, things like, as well as things like Public Enemy and Hunter S. Thompson, Charles Bukowski, Henry Miller. And I also had a pretty big nose for Trouble. In my late teen years through my early 30s, I played in a band. And then I kind of hit a wall in my early 30s where I realized that my cause for existence was really focused on self-gratification. And I think I started to see that there was a real connection between my drive to self-gratification and the suffering of other people. At the time, my girlfriend and I started to do some activist work in and around Los Angeles. We did some work with some human trafficking groups. We did some work with some inner city youth groups, and started to realize that all these groups, they definitely serve a vital function, but there's also sort of a band-aid nature to this sort of thing. And I think we really felt like we wanted to go to the core and really fight what was the cause, what was, you know, causing the need for all these band-aids. So mm-hmm. We did a lot of research and an awful lot of research and spent a lot of time really trying to find, you know, what is the organization, where can we go that we can tap into and put all of our efforts into the greater good and to that fight against the idea of profit over people. And gradually that led us to, you know, the Socialist Party USA. And really think at that point, like I said, because for me personally, so much of my experience and what I was all about was about self-gratification. And I realized I was clueless. I could not participate in much of a meaningful conversation. And as I started to learn, the more I learned, the more I realized how little I knew. And I really felt disconnected from humanity. And then, as you said, once you start to do the research and once you start to actually dig into the facts, then sort of, you know, your eyes start to open a little bit and you start to see why this all makes sense, why socialism makes sense. And it also starts to make sense. You notice that the people who advocate on for socialist policy, why are they so passionate about it? Why are they so fervent about it, you know? And you realize that, well, there's an urgency for this, you know?
Yes.
We're on the brink of environmental collapse. Our economic collapse is here. And all indicators say, well, this is going to get worse, you know? And then you realize that your family members, your friends, your communities, that they've all just been devastated, you know, and the success stories of the capitalist success stories, you know, very few get to experience that success. And the more that you do your research into socialism, the more you start to see answers. I often tell people, don't take my word for it. You know, anybody can tell you anything. And while I may have done my research, don't take my word for it. Find out for yourself. Make it personal, you know. Draw your own connections. And usually when you head, at least in my experience, when you head in that route, when you start to personalize this and find out the information for yourself, it becomes much more real. It becomes less of an abstract, you know. And I think that you're starting to see now, you know, in the United States, more and more and more people, especially as we get distance from the Cold War and distance from sort of the federal government's propaganda campaign to sort of smear the word socialism, communism, people are starting to open up a little bit more to it about what it means. And I think there was a Gallup poll maybe in 2011 where folks between the ages of 18 and 29, I think 63% of them may have had a favorable perception of socialism. And it actually pulled higher than their perception of capitalism. So to us, it's really fascinating.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. It,
it is, right? And it's, I think there is real reason for hope. But while there's reason, while there is that reason for hope, there is also urgency. So when you see folks, socialists, and they are so fervent about their belief in socialism and trying to explain this to people, well, it's because of the urgent nature of this, where, you know, the environmental collapse is here. You know, the economic collapse, it's here. And it's not going away, you know. So it's all these things start to make sense once you really start to devote a little bit. It doesn't even have to be a lot, but just a little bit of attention to this.
Well, right. We don't have 1,000 years to get it right. And so that's why I think that we seem more impassioned, maybe, because once we ourselves get it, like you said, you know, do your research, and then you see that, man, we've got to make some changes soon. So
yes,
I wanted to ask you, there's a lot of branches, whatever, socialist parties in the world. We'll just talk about it in the United States. There's several. What made you choose Socialist Party USA, Mimi?
I think initially it was, I noticed that on the Socialist Party's website, it said multi-tendency. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant. And so I just did a little bit of research into that and to find out that it's not a strict doctrine, or there's not one strict doctrine that party membership has to follow. I don't like being told what to do. I feel that I'm capable of making my own decisions, of informing myself, and, you know, I want some autonomy. So as I did my research and started to find out more about the all the social groups throughout the United States, many of which are fantastic and should be supported, I felt that that multi-tenancy nature of the Socialist Party and the fact that it was a democratic Socialist Party where there was such an emphasis on democracy, kind of inspired me to pick up the phone and call the national office. And when I did, and I got to talk to the national secretary, a guy
you
named Greg
Payson.
Greg Payson.
Yeah.
And to talk to him, I think my expectation was that I was going to be on the phone with somebody who was really sort of this highbrow academic. And not that Greg's not academic, but he's a real guy, you know? I mean, he's a... He's a father. He struggles. He is. He's got a real blue collar approach to the issue, and to me, I felt really comfortable. You know, and he was just really warm, and it was like I was talking to somebody that I'd been friends with for a long time. He was to me, you know, somebody that I may have skateboarded with back in Reading. You know,
there you go. Yeah.
You know, and knowing how and learning more about him, how hard he works, you know, and the guy works for no thanks. And, you know, as sort of kind of a more prominent socialist in the country, if anything, you know, he's going to inspire some hostility from the folks who are really fighting on behalf of capitalism. You know, the guy gets very little thanks. But he does this as sort of out of, you know, there's a decency, there's a want for better, you know. And I felt like, okay, I can throw my hat into the ring with this guy, you know. And then as I started to meet more and more folks in the Socialist Party and to see that, well, it's not just him. These people are all over the place, you know. Really felt like, you know, I made the right choice. We do work with a lot of the other socialist organizations throughout the country and work with some really fantastic people. You know, they all may have different beliefs, but by and large, we're fighting a common enemy, and that enemy is capitalism. I did also, you know, you read the history of the Socialist Party, you know, it was kind of inspired by the history, and, you know, it's been something else. It's been a lot of fun, but it's also been really fulfilling, you know. I think because the party is such a heavy focus on democracy, the party mandates gender parity. That initially, I think it can be a little bit, it can set you back a second when you're in a situation where your democratic participation, it's expected. Well, as we go through our institutions in life, whether it's school or work, we usually, we rarely have a voice in what it is we do. So initially, when you get into an organization like this where that's the expectation, it takes you a second to sort of kind of get up to speed with what that means, you know? And it's really been a learning process for me.
Well, okay, so Greg is the national secretary. Are there other... Now, you are the male vice chair for the Social Support USA. I mean, and that's for the whole country. Are there a lot of different offices, or do you keep that down to a minimum?
We have a national committee, and the chairs, they sit on that national committee.
Okay.
Like I said, for you have an equal number of women to men. And the function is basically to, because the party is a membership party, it's to serve the will of the membership and to be responsive to what the membership wants. The people who come to the Socialist Party, generally, they're looking for action. You know, they want participation. Maybe they've also, they see this as being sort of an urgent situation. So as a national committee, you need to be responsive to what it is they want, to serve as a facilitator, to help the communication process. And if you don't, well, there's a problem, you know, and the party membership is, they're not going to be happy. So, you know, much of this national committee in the Socialist Party, much of its function is serving the will of the party membership.
Give me some examples, because, I mean, that's what every... organization would say, right, we serve the will of the people. But, I mean, what do the people come to you with? They email,
sure.
They call. What kind of situations do they want help with?
Okay, here's a perfect example. At the beginning of June, we had a national committee meeting in Minneapolis. In the month or so prior to that, there was a party member in Los Angeles who had said that he felt that there should be, or that there could be, sort of a video report from the national secretary on a monthly basis, updating every single member about what's going on a national level, on the national level from the party, that he, this particular member, he knew what was happening locally. And while, as a party member, you do get emails from the national office, he wanted, he felt it would be really important if we had a video presentation that sort of provided kind of a warmer and friendlier version of what's going on nationally. So, you know, he just put forth sort of a resolution and email. It was taken to the national committee meeting, and it was passed. So... throughout the country, you'll have people who will have different ideas like this, like, this is what I'd like to see, this is what I want the organization to be, this is what I want the organization to focus on. Perhaps they'd like a statement issued by the party in response to a particular current event. So they do that, they contact the national committee, and we respond.
Okay. So does being on the national committee take up a lot of time? Now, I'm not talking about Greg, the secretary, but
sure.
For the rest of you, does it take up a lot of time, or do you do like Skype video meetings every couple weeks, or what?
Sure. For me personally, I work on it daily. I'll usually talk to Greg every day, sometimes every other day. I'll talk to other national committee members, whether it's through an online chat or a phone call, almost daily. There's always something going on that has to be done. There's always a situation that requires attention. So it's a daily effort.
Okay. That's, and working with, shall we say, low budget, that can make it sort of tough sometimes.
We aren't a party that accepts corporate donations.
Right.
So our budget is entirely made up through our membership. And one thing that might make us a little bit different than a lot of other organizations is we have a very low membership fee. As a matter of fact, I think as a student, as your first-time membership in the Socialist Party, it's $15 a year. So it definitely puts we definitely have a limited budget. We do fundraise, but by and large, the money that we have comes from our membership. So there's nothing more important than our membership, than party members.
What kind of fundraising do you do?
Go ahead, I'm sorry?
What kind of fundraising do you do?
Sometimes we'll do just like email campaigns for our party membership. Sometimes, like in Los Angeles, we may do a yard sale. Or we may host a conference. This past year in Memphis, we had an organizing conference. You do things like this to generate funds for the party. In October, we'll have our national convention, registration fees and also a dinner that we host, that will raise funds.
Where will that be? Where's the national convention?
That's going to be in New York City, October 25th through October 27th.
Okay. So do you do like online sales, some kind of socialist t-shirts, anything like
mm-hmm.
that?
Okay. We do. On the national website, yes. On the national website, you'll see some things that we have for sale. We just did a poetry journal that you can buy, and it was party members submitted poetry. So we will do things like that for sale. It's not like we're going to make a ton of money off of these things.
Oh, right.
Oftentimes it's just a little bit above cost, but we will do things like that.
Okay,
so, it is really grassroots.
Yeah. Right. Well, now this is what you do as the male vice chair at the Socialist Party USA. But so what do you do as chair of the Socialist Party of California, maybe?
Top on the list is making sure that our membership is informed about what our locals are doing. How can our membership throughout the state participate in local functions? A lot of it is establishing lines of communication between new party members and their closest local representation. So that if you get somebody who comes in, say, to Los Angeles, to make sure that they're put in touch right away with the Los Angeles local. And I keep them posted on a weekly basis, what's going on throughout the state, what's going on the national level. What sort of campaigns can they participate in? And then it can be calling members if their membership dues are about to expire, let them know, just to give them a reminder. If somebody is choosing to leave the party, I want to find out why. Is there something that we could have done better? Is there something that they'd like to see? Also, you know, it's making decisions about is there a statement that the state would like to release? Organizing trips, say, to the national convention, making sure that California's delegates that they're allotted to the national convention, making sure that that process is facilitated. And a lot of times, too, it's just being responsive to individual members, making yourself available to individual members throughout the state who have questions or concerns, just to be responsive, to be there for them, to help them do whatever it is that they'd like to do.
Well, now, is California one of the bigger socialist states in this country?
As far as the Socialist Party USA goes, I think it's the biggest.
Oh.
And because, you know, I think there are whatever 38 million people in the country, that's not really a testament to the Socialist Party of California having, you know, like the best organizing strategy, as much as it is, we have a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in my mind, our membership could and should be much bigger than it is. However, we are pretty new. There had been no party in California, I think, for over a decade. And we, after making that phone call with Greg and getting in touch with Stuart Alexander, we started to work to rebuild a state chapter. And within, the 2.5 years, it's grown in membership. But there's still a long way to go. I mean, we're still sort of babies at this whole thing out here. We now have 3 locals, one in the Bay Area, one in Ventura County, that's really vibrant, and a Los Angeles local that's really active. And we're working right now on San Diego, and hopefully Sacramento and a few other places as well. Orange County, San Bernardino County, Riverside County, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I know several people in California who are socialists. I mean, that's why I asked, because it seems like the people I know, California's the state. Which is great. I wondered, have you found a lot of good? Well, you talked about people who actually thought that socialism was not a bad thing. We have met several young people who are very gung-ho, and I find that very exciting. I'm sure you're running into them, too.
Usually, especially here in Los Angeles, most of our new membership and most of the folks who come to us are relatively young. We have a lot of college students. We have some high school students. And because their experience hasn't been that socialism is sort of a negative, because they've grown up, after the Cold War, they really don't understand why it's seen as a negative, because they've done the research and seen, why it is that somebody would want to support this. It makes sense to them. So the fact that there would be sort of this negative response to us or to socialism, they see as being kind of silly and really counterproductive. You know, these young folks are insanely bright and really inspiring. And, at each meeting that we have in Los Angeles, you'll have a handful of new young folks, and they just, I'm just always floored by how bright they are and how astute, how mindful they are of humanity. It's something else. It's been quite an experience.
Well, they aren't bringing all that baggage with them, and it is amazing, because some of the ones I know and talk with frequently, and they aren't coming out of field of clover either. I mean, some of them have had a pretty rough time growing up and everything, but they see how capitalism has totally failed, and.
Yes.
Like you said, they don't have the negative connotations associated with the word. So they are extremely bright, though. They get it. They get politics. They get the world situation. They get these things, whereas some older people with the baggage, I'm not saying it's their fault, but, they come with all these preconceived ideas that have been hammered into them for so long. And it's hard sometimes to, make that dent. But once you make the dent, and then if you can just slit something in there, then they start researching, like you were saying. And
they do,
what they find. Would you give us some of the principles? Like you said principles pretty much are the same, but this is not a dogmatic party, because you can still be an individual and be with the Socialist Party USA. But what are some of the main platform items that you would, somebody said, give me the top 10.
I think you start with, first off, this deep commitment to freedom and equality for everyone. That's full freedom of speech, assembly, press, religion. I know that this may rub some folks the wrong way, but we are really strongly dedicated to kind of the abolition of male supremacy, of patriarchy, of class society. And to us, things like equality, like gender equality, that's not for debate. You know, that's not there's no reform there. You know, I think right now, whereas a woman might make 77 cents or 78 cents to the dollar that every man's going to make for the same job with the same qualifications, a discussion about bringing that woman up to 82 cents, to us, that's just unacceptable, you know.
Right.
Until that ratio is 1-to-1, this is not a negotiation. So to us, you know, we are staunchly opposed to that oppression. And whether it's race, sexual preference, national origin, disabilities, just erasing, you know, oppression and the causes of oppression. Of course, a big one is production for use, not for profit, not for the ability of some and a very small sum to exploit the masses for profit. You know, part of this is as worker community control, a democratic voice in the workplace. Another big one for us is environmental sanity. Almost like the gender equality issue, when science tells you that we are collapsing environmentally, it's as in it's over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a negotiation. You know, we can't negotiate with nature and say, well, can you give us another 20 years? Can you give us another 50 years? You know, this is urgent. And when we say that we are looking for radical change, well, these conditions require radical change. People may want to run from the word radical. Well, these conditions require radical change to reach points of equality or environmental sanity. It requires a radical change. So that's sort of at the top, equality, production for use. Of course, employment, full employment for all, and a democratic voice in the workplace, worker control, community control, environmental sanity. You know, it's really, although we are, we do run electoral campaigns, I sort of view this almost as a humanitarian effort, you know. So much of the work that we do and so much of our messaging is based on equality and you know, erasing, destroying oppression, that where the electoral arena sits for us, it's not at the top like it might be with some other organizations or some other parties.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You did mention the democratic workplace, and I'm real big on worker-owned means of production.
Absolutely.
Like
yep.
Mondragon in Spain and everything. I just get all excited over them and anything that's like that. Here in this country,
absolutely,
there's quite a bit going on in Cleveland. I don't know,
yes,
does California have, are they working on this? I mean, worker-owned factories and businesses?
Yeah, there are some. And actually, mm-hmm, one thing I wanted to bring up, I think one of our next projects within the Los Angeles local, and we also work really tightly with the Ventura County local, is establishing a cooperative. And I think over the next year that there's going to be a heavy focus on establishing a cooperative and seeing that cooperative movement grow. I think one of our members in New York participated in the creation of a community-owned or cooperatively-owned credit union.
Wow.
And, yes, so... that worker ownership, that those community-based cooperatives, that is a big focus.
Oh, well, it only makes sense. But that's something that comes when we discover we don't need to have businesses for profit. We need to have businesses to support the laborer. And we don't have to have these huge corporations where one man in a day makes more than one of the employees in a year. You know, there's something so innately wrong about that. I mean, I don't have words for it because it just makes me want to blow up. It's just so wrong.
It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. It's disgusting. It's inhumane. So
we have to get away from that. And, you know, I mean, I talk with people quite a bit. I was pleasantly surprised because I tell people I've got very conservative relatives, you know, run something by them. And if it gets to them, it's like, oh, my God. And recently, that's been happening. Different things that I've been saying, they haven't jumped on me.
Right.
Like happened before when I would make remarks about the military or something, because there's a lot of military people in my family. And now it's like, you know, they look at me and they say, you're right.
Yes.
And I've about fallen out because it's like, wow, they're getting it. And, you know, like everybody's friends and family, I mean, they're wonderful people, they're very loving and all this, but they just haven't been in that mindset. But once, you know, you have to just keep talking, even if you think you're talking to the wall, and then all of a sudden, something, plus everything that's going on around them, you know, they start to get it, and it feels like, hallelujah. You know?
Absolutely. I think one of the positives to social networking is that people of that get access to information internationally and very quick, very fast. And they get access to facts very quick. I mean, you can share a fact or a study with somebody in real time, you know. So it becomes a little bit more different to spin and to you know, prove your point with just, you know, conjecture or supposition, because people have access to facts quickly. So I think what's happening is you're seeing a lot of the more the foolish conservative, the punditry, well, it's starting to look really out of touch. You know, you know, not that it wasn't before, not, you know, the Sean Hannitys, the Bill O'Reillys, the Rush Limbaughs, those sorts of things. I mean, in now that people have access to information and to fact, that sort of thing is starting to just look really foolish, silly, out of touch. And by no means am I saying that the liberal, quote unquote, liberal press is much better, because it's not. But I think on the conservative side, I think you're seeing a lot more people, because it's getting harder to spin, you know, the company line on the conservative side, that they might be a little bit more receptive to these kinds of ideas. And I also think many of them, you know, these people work, you know, they go to school, and they're burdened with a lot of this, well, or with just all the same, you know,
they're experiencing it, like student loans, things like that. You know, it's like, what the heck? We should have free education, you know, I mean, K through whatever. And this is ridiculous. People get out of college and between $50,000 and $100,000 debt is not unusual. Or
absolutely,
and that is just appalling. That should not be at all. So once we can eliminate the for profit and just start worried about people taking care of each other, and, you know, like the automation socialism, where things, because we know that we're having all kinds of robotic things for factories and different things like that, and it's fine if you work 2 hours a day. And, you know, everything's taken care of. Hey, who wouldn't really like that? Because then you have the time to do what makes your heart sing, whether it's spending with your family, your kids, writing that book that you never had time to write before, that kind of thing.
Right, to enjoy your life, to live a full and rich life, you know, to spend the time with your children. Yes,
right.
I agree. I think what's been really interesting, and again, some of this with social networking, it makes this sort of thing easier, is that when you get into some sort of conversation or even an argument about socialism, you can, let's just take healthcare, where you can show quickly that the last time the World Health Organization did a study of the world's healthcare systems, the countries with a socialized medical program generally tend to rank at the top, whereas the United States ranks at about number 38 or 39. At the same time, the United States is the costliest. So this isn't even a dollars and cents issue, you know. It's, you know, that argument that, well, you know, I don't want to pay for somebody else to have it easy. Right now you're paying more than anybody else. You're paying more than any other country. And you're getting substandard care. And those countries that are offering socialized medical programs, they're offering a higher quality medical care at a fraction of the cost that you're paying here. You know, the reality is you are being taxed, but your tax dollar, it's going to the military, you know. Corporate America, they're not paying their fair share of taxes. You know, we have to start to explain to people, you know, here in the United States, we have a regressive tax policy, you know. The less you make, the heavier the tax burden is on you, you know. So we have that responsibility to let people know, again, this is an opinion, this is fact, you know. And I think you can reach conservatives with fact. Let's just talk about fact, you know, and providing them with just the facts about socialized medical programs. Let's take, you know, what's considered to be the world's top-ranked educational system is Finland, who offers a socialized education program in higher education, where in here in the United States, over the last 30 years, the cost of education has risen 1,120%, you know.
That's horrid. You know what, Mimi? We've got John Strinka on the line. You know John,
sure.
Right?
I do.
So
yes.
Called in. Hi, John.
Hey, Ruthann. How you doing?
Hey, my friend.
I just gotta say I love John. John is fantastic.
Thank you, sir. Well, the feeling is mutual. I was listening to the show, and actually the audio cut out on my computer, so I figured I'd pick up the phone and hear the rest and just maybe chime in a little bit. But I'm glad to hear you doing Ruthann's show, and I think you're, as always, a very capable spokesman for socialism. So I just wanted to call for a minute, chime in, lend my support. And I
appreciate
what you're doing
that
on the West Coast, running for office, is a great thing. Yeah, it really is. And you'll see as you go along that, you know, you will get people to listen and people will pick up on it. I mean, it's like you said at the top of the program, you know, we don't necessarily look to win the election, but, you know, our victory is in, you know, helping people to understand the situation that they're in and,
opening,
you know, seeing socialist answers as a viable alternative. So I just wanted to chime in and you know, give you my support.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that, as always.
You, John, I wanted to say about your phone, or you said that it was your laptop. Blog Talk is having some issues right now with voice dropouts, and they said that the archives won't be affected. So
I can get it on the archive. Yeah, it was just, I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, sometimes electronic stuff is sketchy. The first 40 minutes were about, we're fine, and then, you know, and then the audio just cut out. So, but I caught most of it.
Well, it could be Blog Talk because they've got the sign up in the studio about it, but they're saying that the archive won't be affected, and they're working on it. They thought they had it fixed, but not quite. So, yeah. But thank you for calling in. It's always good to hear from you, my friend.
And before I go, I just want to pop up one other thing. But in addition to Mimi's campaign, and of course he tells you a little bit about what he does as vice chair, but Mimi has been very active in reaching out nationally, you know, to all the members and so forth, and that's really been something that helps. But in particular, I wanted to just kind of give due credit. I was out of town last week. I came back Tuesday, and I checked my electronic media, and Mimi was hard at it. Los Angeles Local put together a reach-out effort to protest the Syrian war. And Mimi himself organized basically a call-in urging all the party members to call their congressmen and basically spreading it right on Facebook. So all of us, you know, listed to our contacts. And whereas we can't necessarily say our representatives are going to listen to us, we have probably generated literally thousands of calls telling them that, hey, look, this Syria is a bad idea. We don't need to be bombing people.
Right.
And that did not come up in your earlier conversation, but Mimi pretty much put that together himself. And for whatever good it does, at least Congress people all around the country know that there are a substantial number of people who think this whole Syria thing is a very, very bad idea.
Right. I was giving Syria for the end because I wanted to ask him what because I know he got that campaign going. I think that's great.
Absolutely. And people like John have been really receptive to this sort of thing, and have been aggressive about contacting their representatives to let them know that this is completely unacceptable. So it's really been fantastic. And I think it does show you that people have a lot more power than they might think that they do. You know, it's just taking that step forward and taking control of that power. And that's one example. People have been just fantastic.
Yeah. I'll paraphrase, probably not very well, Margaret Mead, who said, never think that a small group of people can't change the world. In fact, that's the only kind that ever has. So I think that what we may lack in numbers right now, we're making up in enthusiasm and that radicalism, which is
absolutely no shortage of effort. Here in Los Angeles, the Socialist Party is working with some of the other socialist organizations, and we put together an eco-socialist conference that's going to happen on September 21st in Los Angeles. And we're really expecting a great turnout, and you are really seeing a cooperative effort here on the left. Like I said, there's urgency with these issues, and you're seeing people more and more taking the step forward to say, no more, this game is over, So whether it be a student debt campaign that we might run, or the calling campaign to Syria, or the eco-socialist conference, people are stepping forward, and it's been really inspiring. It's been inspiring for me.
Well, and when somebody has one of those causes as their main cause, then they meet people from the others, and while that may not become their main, there will be a lot of crossover and helping each other out.
Absolutely. We've had a great time working with some of the other groups that have been putting together this environmental eco-socialist conference here in Los Angeles. And I think that those relationships are going to carry over to future unified efforts. That's another reason for hope. There's been so much of a call for unity on the left. And here is a perfect example of how unity on the left can work to accomplish something meaningful and impactful. And I think you'll start to see more and more and more of that kind of thing.
Right. So if we can get past the little nitpicky disagreements that we may have and concentrate on what we all have in common.
Yes.
To work together and do something about this. We have a lot of support, actually. Maybe it's just good thoughts, whatever, but from our comrades around the world, it's amazing how supportive they are. I talked to them, and on Skype and online, and they're amazing, and they're really supportive. You know, it's like, come on, you guys, you know, you can do it kind of thing. So
that's so good to hear. And I do think that because of the unbelievable power of the United States, that there is every reason in the world to see this movement grow in the United States. Because, you know, just the future of the planet in a very real way depends on it, depends on this movement growing and expanding.
Very tangible.
Mm.
So I wanted to say that Mimi's Facebook page is Medio Mimi, and I'm going to mispronounce Saltific / Socialist Party LA Local for CA State Assembly. And you can probably just go to his regular Facebook page and find it from there, maybe.
Yes, and I actually think there's even just this, like, a direct link. It's just facebook.com/ rad and red in LA, like RADANDRED in LA.
Rad and red in LA. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
That's well, and that's what you are. So, you know,
thank you.
Both of you, we've got about 3 minutes left. Words of wisdom from both of you, Mimi and John Stranka.
Words of wisdom. Go ahead, John.
Well, like as I said, I just called in to kind of support Mimi. I think he's doing a wonderful thing, and as you can see on the program, he is a very articulate spokesperson for socialism. But basically, you know, as Mimi pointed out, you know, I mean, the economic collapse is on us. I mean, everybody's seen it in 2008. Our mission now is really to, you know, to help people understand that and to show them that there are alternatives, and the alternatives lie in the path of, in the way of direct democracy and people basically, you know, asserting their individual freedom and taking control of their own lives and essentially taking back our government and our institutions from the capitalists who have quite frankly stolen them. And if we enough people begin to realize this, you know, we can change things for the better and create systems that really work for people. And that's what Mimi's trying to do, and that's what I'm trying to do. And hopefully, you know, if we keep at it, there will be many, many, many others to join us.
Yes. And I'll tell you what, Ruthann, I think John said that so well that I'd like to leave that last word with John.
Mimi. Okay, then.
That was perfect.
That's great. Thanks, Mimi, for coming on. I want to have you back. And, John, it's always a pleasure to have you on, whether you're
interviewing me
or calling in. So
thank you so much. Have a great night.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
Okay. Have a great
Bye-bye.
Weekend, guys, both of you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I'll do that.